It's that time of year again when your nice hosts take a few weeks off from new episodes. We'll be back at the start of March, but until then, we've picked out a few of our favorites from the past year or so to keep you entertained each week while we're on hiatus.
While you wait, you can get these and all our episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus audio that's pretty nice too, at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
This week's Nice Replay is episode 282. Today is the day I screw things up. Pre-production, Idle Games. Originally published October 13th, 2022. One thing I like about digging a little further back for a Nice Replay is to relive what was going on in our lives back then. This episode starts with some big good news for Ellen, and later in the episode, some bad news for me, which I'd completely forgotten about and inspired my topic for this episode. Final note before the episode starts, you've probably noticed that for Nice Replays, we replace the standard intro and theme song with this bit, so you can get right into the episode. And I'll do the same here, except for this extra part that's wasting your time just now. But I actually recommend you go back and listen to the original intro if you get the chance, because it's an all-timer.
Nice game, dogs. Cool. How are you guys?
All right. So that's not the only thing going on with you.
Yes.
Are we going to create a whole list?
No, I mean, because it's in the meta.
Yeah, it's in the meta.
No, I know. Yeah. I started a new job today.
Yeah. Woo.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, I'm a lead game designer at the game agency. Lead game designer.
Let's go.
At the game agency, they've been around for over a decade, and they are a platform that does like quizzes and learning games and things like that. They have a whole platform called the Training Arcade, and this was day one, so like I'm just getting my feet under me, I'm just getting my bearings, and they're part of a larger company, and it's definitely the biggest organization I've ever worked for, so it's. It's weird. It's a different feeling than what I'm used to.
Sure.
You know, so that's going to be an adjustment, but it doesn't matter because I'm doing games all the time and I'm very excited.
Lead game designer. That is just, that's such an impressive title. It's imposing.
It kind of freaks me out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for sure. It's not just Monday. Like the imposter syndrome is real, but I think I actually start doing the work instead of just doing all the onboarding tasks, then that'll go away because I'll be focused on the work. Yeah. It'll be fine. And they're a really great group of folks.
Are you leading people then as a result? Like if you are a lead game designer?
Yeah, I don't think that's – I mean, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. Maybe. Right maybe. Now I think it's more like leading the game design philosophy.
Got it.
And the game design efforts in certain areas.
So these are projects which will sort of have departments of one. In many cases?
Or? No. I'll be interfacing with they have like a 5-person dev team with additional senior devs who come in and support the core team. And then there's a full-time like visual/UX designer that I work with. And like a lot of other games have sound, you know, their games have sound design and music and things like that. So,
but still per department, a pretty low number of folks.
Yeah. I mean, like the 5 to 7... No, 5 to 8. Yeah, they have like 5 core game, I think, developers, and then like the 3 additional people are there to help like boost capacity if they need to do more things on the platform. Yeah, I don't know. It's first day. I'm just figuring it out.
That's fair.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not a huge team. It's a regular sized team, and there's only one team. I guess is the way I'd talk about it.
Yeah.
But the larger organization is like a few hundred people. So it's definitely a different vibe, and lots of people are working remotely.
Like, oh, sure.
There are other people who work for the company who are in the Twin Cities area, and actually one of them like lives just across the river from me. But you know, we hung out together before, but we don't have like a central office space.
Okay.
Here, so.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, that's a good fit for you because you spent the last year doing a lot of freelance stuff.
Yeah.
And so you're sort of used to that kind of. You know, remote lifestyle anyway.
Yeah.
And you did remote at your last job a little bit, right? Over the pandemic.
Yeah. Over the pandemic, things switched to remote and then I switched to contracting and then I switched jobs.
Right.
And that's the last 2 years, basically.
So lots of big changes, but some of the things that come with a job change you actually won't change for you.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, I got up at the same time and I did the same things and just logged into different browsers and tools.
Sure. Yeah.
But it was definitely, I mean, like the culture is definitely different. Like you're a freelancer, there's a lot of hustling.
Yeah.
But this is, I think it's just the hustle. I keep expecting the other hustle shoe to drop.
Right. You know, like
here's now it's going to be crazy. Go. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's what they're wanting to do. They don't really try to, from what I can tell, they're very sensitive around crunch and things like that. So, yeah, it'll be great. I'm excited.
Cool. That's fantastic.
That's great.
Yay.
Love hearing about our career jumps.
I know, right?
You just keep moving up, y'all.
Just keep at it. Keep practicing the art and stuff happens because mm-hmm. you get better.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do it.
All right, I got a topic.
Uh-huh.
You do?
Yes.
Good.
Good. Otherwise, right. We'd have to reschedule this whole recording session.
And we didn't go over them at the top, huh?
Oh, shoot. Yeah.
That's a good point.
Oh, well.
This whole thing is a disaster.
It's going to be a surprise to people who don't look at their podcast player and see the title of the episode.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But dang, no one does that. Anyways, my topic is pre-production, which to me, before I started working at my current job, I was like, pre-production, that's a buzzword. That doesn't mean anything. I now know what it means.
What does it mean aside from stuff that happens before production?
I mean, a lot of it is just like the planning of the production phase, like what you're going to be doing during production.
Yeah.
And so like I've been doing this for work recently, where we're working on a new prototype, but we're kind of trying to self-publish it, sort of, or if we don't get funding for it, we've figured out a way to self-publish it. But ideally we get money, so give us money. But like so a lot of the work that I've been doing has been planning out, because I'm the programmer, I've been planning out the systems in the back end so that it'll better support my production work and other people's production work during the process of production, which is when you're like actively developing a lot of the things. Mm-hmm. And I find a lot of value in pre-production, largely due to the fact that like it feels nice to kind of know what you're going to be working on a lot of the time. Like you're not going to figure out everything when you're doing pre-production stuff, but like you're going to figure out a lot of it, and it's going to feel more like an actual game and not just like an idea that's been in your head for a long period of time. I don't know. Have y'all done like official quote unquote pre-production stuff in the past?
Well, I would guess between the two of us, Ellen, you probably in a designer capacity have done more than I have. Mm.
Yeah, I think I'm just thinking back to all like the various projects I've been on. So I've done pre-production from an instructional design or curriculum development perspective.
Okay.
And recently, over the last 12 months, have done some pre-production from a game development perspective on some of the larger games that I was working on. Mm. And it's fun because it is like this bridge between an idea and then things that actually start becoming concrete. And I think the thing that's really, this is the emotional experience of pre-production, according to Ellen. but like, you know, when you start an idea, it's like this fragile thing,
yep.
Right? And then you kind of put some pieces together and you're like, okay, how do we make it more of a thing? And you add some more pieces or you reconfigure some things and it becomes a little more solid.
Yes.
And it's that experience that to me, that's what pre-production brings, right?
Yeah.
You're getting some of these details, and as you add these details and you start making plans about, okay, we're going to have this many phases of the game, which means we need this many different backgrounds, and we are going to need to have probably about this many mini games, you know, so on and so forth.
Right.
Like you don't exactly know what they are, but you're coming up with like the structure, mm-hmm. and then when you have that structure, it just feels like a solid thing.
Yeah.
And that's a cool experience.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's the experience I've been having, and it's been nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Though it's been kind of interesting because like sometimes we have a lot of meetings. You'll have a lot of meetings when you're doing pre-production. That's just the nature of it. You gotta have a lot of conversations to solidify these things. Mm-hmm. But while we're having these conversations, they've all been productive and valuable, but every once in a while, people will like kind of lean towards a direction, and I've noticed myself feeling a little disappointed in that direction. And it's not necessarily because I don't like that direction, because I'm like, yeah, that's a nice direction. It makes sense. And like sometimes I'll be like, yeah, during the meeting, I'll be like, yeah, this is great. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it is just like the ideal really that you've like thought of for this game starts to like fade away, mm-hmm. and starts becoming more of a real thing.
Well, yeah, it comes into focus.
Yeah.
It can't be anything anymore.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't feel like a dream. It feels more like a reality in a way that is a little, I don't know. Yeah, I guess it feels a little disappointing in a way.
What it also does is it moves that solidification process to pre-production instead of where it feels more magical and fun, which is during production.
Yeah.
but also inefficient and, you know, and dangerous.
Yes. Right. Absolutely.
Kind of like aging.
What?
I kind of expect you guys to just get it. It makes me feel really old that you didn't. Well, you know, like when you're younger, you're like, okay, you've got this all these possibilities in the future. And then as time goes on, like your options are restricted just by the factor of you don't have as much time left.
Right. There's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
And there's things that you thought maybe I'll do. And then you're like, well, I guess I'm never going
to
do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay. That's a way to spin it that makes it sound very depressing.
Yeah.
So, thanks for that.
Well, I can speak to my experience with pre-production in film and commercial video projects.
Sure.
Which is essentially much more defined than it is in games.
Oh, okay.
And which is like you can't shoot without a script.
Right.
Right? Whereas you can start production on a video game without
any of the,
a lot of things you would need, right?
Yep.
So there are things, and so I'm pretty familiar with that structure.
Okay.
And a lot of times what you in those fields, and this includes like client work, you're doing commercial work, or you're doing motion graphics for a client or something like that.
Yeah.
A lot of times you have storyboards, you have scripts, you have meetings about style and things that will essentially build the blueprint for your project.
Yeah.
And then the actual making of the project, in games, it can feel like, oh, you've closed off so many doors.
Right.
But in my experience, because I came up with that kind of structure, the pre-production, production, post-production. Like that's with really defined lines between them.
Yeah.
And when there's overlap, it's like scary and no one likes it.
Oh. Okay.
It happens, right? You're like, well, the client has not approved this script, so we'll start shooting it. And if they don't approve the changes by whatever, then we'll just decide on the day.
Yeah.
Nobody likes that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But it happens, right? Mm-hmm. Or certainly when you're shooting a production as a larger production, you edit as you go sometimes to get a feel for one, as a director, you want to see like how a performance is playing on screen and that can inform your direction on set the next day or whatever.
Yeah.
And, and you want to see how the scenes are paced. Mm. So you were like, oh, we didn't shoot enough coverage on these scenes, so I'll make sure we do more. So there's some of that overlap happens, and it's similar to how games are produced as standard, I think. Certainly indie games are, there's a lot more of that overlap and more changing as you go, because you just can more often.
Well, you can, and it feels I think part of it is like the games feel a little more amorphous as you're developing them.
Right. Well, yeah, well, put them in front of playtesters, you know, like, oh, you know what, we need to make big changes here.
Yeah,
it's not something that happens in other fields as much.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
But I think people should not be afraid to front load that process.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what the pre-production is.
And we talk about iteration, playtesting, agile.
Yeah.
And all of those things are a little allergic to like having your blueprint ready to go.
Yeah.
But I think you shouldn't feel like that those things are totally mutually exclusive.
Well, exactly, because like the process of doing this isn't necessarily set in stone, this is what my game is now. Right. I cannot change from this plan. It's more like you plan out these things so you have an idea of how long it's going to take you, mm-hmm. what kind of resources you're going to need, the different kinds of things you'll be doing during production.
Yeah.
And then, you get to production, and 3 months down production, you're like, oh, actually, this level doesn't really make sense. We need to replace this with something else. Or, oh, it actually is going to take way more work to create all the art assets we need. We need to hire another artist or something like that. And so then you go back to the drawing board and you adjust as you go.
Right. It key to that is that you go back into pre-production mode.
Yes.
I mean, it's a little more fly by night.
Yeah.
But you don't just make the changes on the fly in with the sort of production mindset.
Yeah.
You do have to take a step back, I think, to make the, to, and that's not true of every little tweak you want to make.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it can be if you're going to make major changes.
Yes.
Because,
absolutely.
Yeah. When you actually just sit down and like just with a room full of people, or if it's just you, you and your notes, and not think about it in terms of like, iterating until you get there all the time. Yeah. Sometimes you can actually just think your way to a solution.
Yeah.
And can shortcut some of that iterative process and only have to make two or three iterations rather than 12.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but I think that's a good point that it's important to, you know, actively plan it and not just like, you know, make a change so you can keep working, because that can be dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you have to do that though, but that's, you know, it depends on where you're, where you are in the project and what you're doing for the project. It's a little, it's much more dangerous when like people's salaries are on the line.
So
I guess I have like a list of things that are valuable for people to go over during pre-production. And we can talk about them. And I'm sure there, this is not an exhaustive list, but you know, things that you'll come up with as you do it. So one thing I've been doing is like tools you'll need during production, specifically like pick a game engine. That's probably important. Maybe do that even before pre-production. But like there's, you know, you'll realize there will be tools that you will want as you're making the thing. One thing I did when I was working on Rhythm Rumble is there was this asset, I can't remember the name of the asset right now, but it was like a rhythm tool that would, I think it was called Rhythm Tool, that would, you know, keep track of the beats of songs and stuff. And I wanted to make sure that I was like, oh, can I get this thing so I can work with it and understand how it works and things and mess with it so that I can create things I need to make this work for our project, stuff like that. You want to have like a design overlook, like you want to have a general idea of what, how the game plays in like the core game loop. What players will be doing over the game, basic narrative beats, you know, the progression. I don't write, but that's what our writer has been doing is the stuff. Come up with like a list of art assets that you will need. And you know, it's not an exhaustive list. You're going to want to have, you're going to want to have an idea of what art assets you'll need, but odds are you're probably going to be like, oh, actually we might need this animation for blah blah blah, or we might need this fancy picture or something for
a character. All of this is just getting you ready for when you need those things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it doesn't have to be, it's not, you don't have to have it all nailed down totally.
Yeah.
But you have to at least understand that this is the type of thing we'll need, and we'll need about this much of it, we think.
Yeah.
And so let's make sure we have the tools and the budget and the labor ready to go for that.
Yeah.
And so that when inevitably it changes a little bit, we'll at least, we won't have to move too far from, because we've thought about it already.
Yeah. It's really fascinating, too, because, like, you know, the Future Club is mostly animators and artists. And so, like, they have a pipeline for this kind of stuff established quite strongly, I think. And it makes it interesting jumping into that, working in previous places where that wasn't the case. And not just, like, and it wasn't just because, like, my job didn't know what they were doing. I think it was more just like, that's just not how we worked. And so I was more accustomed to just like kind of working and not necessarily doing this planning stuff ahead of time, a lot of it. It's interesting to just see that mindset change for like creating art assets and things, because I think it's valuable. It was very valuable for them to know the kind of stuff going into it. It's just kind of an interesting mind shift.
Do you prefer one over the other, or is it too early to tell?
That's a good question. I think that I do like pre-production as a concept, because I feel more prepared I feel more knowledgeable about what I will need to do. But there's something that's interesting about like just messing with stuff and just getting and just like, you know, doing things without necessarily having a plan for them. I think that I think this is valuable for anybody, whether you're a hobbyist or AAA or whatever. But I think that, you know, when you're a hobbyist, you're just working on it because like you're enjoying making games. You don't necessarily have to do a lot of this stuff. I think that it can be valuable. And it can make the task of creating the game less daunting when you're 3 months in and the magic is gone from the project. It could just be nice to know, oh, I've got this list of tasks. I'm just going to pull this task today and just do this task today because I've got the time for it on the energy. But there's also something to be said for like discovering and experimenting with your game and just being able to like, you know, flow with it. That's what we did with Vengeance, right? I mean, we did it for a very long time, but there was a lot of fun about discovering new ways to create parts and characters and enemies and things that I think was that I don't think that game would be as good as it is now if we just planned a lot of that stuff out ahead of time.
Yeah.
I think we would have finished it earlier if we had planned a lot of that stuff out ahead of time. but I think that, like, you know, there was some stuff, there would be some things that were lost if we didn't make those, if we didn't just like do things kind of. Mm-hmm.
There are just so many good quotes about planning that were brought up in like the Agile training that I did way back in the day. And I can't remember them exactly. So but today's the day where I screw things up. So it's something like a plan, like the act of planning is priceless, but the plan itself isn't worth the paper that it's written on, you know? And so like the act of planning, especially with your team, gets everyone on roughly the same wavelength, at least on the same like continent, as far as what you're building and what it's going to take to get there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not the plan is not the product. The plan is just a tool to help you get there.
Right.
So you got to be flexible enough to change the plan if you need to and recognize that, you know, it's a plan. It's like an outline, but it's also like you're going to get way more detailed as you move forward.
Yeah.
One other thing that popped up earlier, we were talking about this, is, you know, we had the conversation about games journaling last week.
Right. It's been some time ago.
Two episodes ago for listeners.
Yeah. Okay. So 2 weeks ago. Two episodes ago. Okay. Anyway. and we talked about how like that one of the benefits of journaling is like externalizing your thoughts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And externalizing those thoughts helps you analyze your own thinking around different topics and experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of gives them structure so that it's easier for you to like metacogitate, is that a word, to think about how you're thinking.
Okay.
And I feel like pre-production is kind of the same thing, right? Like you are externalizing your ideas of what the games are in a way that gets pretty specific, but not too specific,
right?
So that everyone can kind of analyze those ideas together and figure out.
Yeah, and that's a good point. That's something I didn't bring up, is that like I think that during the pre-production process, we have solidified the game idea together, so we're all on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like when you're not doing that, like two people can have different ideas and you can be developing the same product and not be on the same page, and that can cause conflict.
And it's important to have those debates before people start putting in hours.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think like, you know, if you work on a game for such a long period of time, you will, if you don't have that kind of plan established, people can like, you know, they'll push it in a direction that you aren't comfortable with, and then there can be a bunch of conflicts and controversy and all this stuff. I think a little bit of that happened in Finch. It's not like actual active controversy, but like we had ideas on what Vengeance was, and we didn't really solidify some of the ideas ahead of time.
Yeah, I feel, I mean, as an observer over many of the years of Vengeance production, I think sometimes like production halted when the three of you couldn't agree on something.
A little bit, yeah.
Until you kind of came back and hammered it out, or someone decided they didn't care as much as they thought they did.
Yeah.
And then you could move forward.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not, I mean, like you say, that game does not purport to have been produced in a professional manner.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is fine as is. It was not like the biggest mistake or anything.
Right.
But like, it wouldn't be the way you'd make games now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Some of those things, I don't know. I think part of that process, what I'd still, you know, do today. But I think, some of the stuff, some of the decisions, some of the way we made decisions, I would have liked to have improved as we did it. That's one of the things that has felt really nice about doing pre-production stuff, is that, like, I really feel like a team. in like we all feel like we're every like when we have regular retrospectives once a month, and every time everybody's like, wow, this game has really come together, y'all. We really feel like that we're all in this, we're all, you know, coming together, and it's starting to really feel like a full thing. And that feels really good to just like have that experience.
To sort of, as you're working and then someone gets something done and everyone has some ownership of it because they're all part of that pre-production process. Yes. And so it's a team accomplishment. It's not, you know, and it's fulfilling the promise rather than just making a cool thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It feels really nice. And plus, you know, like you said, Mark, I think everybody gets like their input on all aspects of it. And I suppose, you would get, especially in the space, you get your input on all aspects of the game, regardless, even during production. But it's nice to have that input during pre-production, because like you can kind of guide all of the different what's the word for all of the things that people do to make games?
disciplines.
Ooh. Thank you. All the different disciplines, you can kind of guide them in a way that feels satisfying enough for you without you necessarily having to do that work.
This goes back a little bit to sort of a perennial topic on the show, which is like game design pillars. So pre-production is where you would, depending on, I mean, everyone does it a little differently, but where you would have your game design document, or you come up with your statement of principles for this project. I mean, it could take any form, right? It could be bullet points, or it could be a 30-page document. But that's where you have that. And so, like you say, the different departments can be on the same page, because one of the things that can be very frustrating, I think, is people doing a lot of great work, but then it doesn't mesh with what the team is working on. And you'll see this in AAA games that have siloed departments, where you'll see like, oh, someone really went for it and did a great job on this thing. It's a weird fit for this game, but okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you want, you know, you don't, you know, you want to have everyone have the ability to make changes on the fly, if that, you know, because that has some, there's some spark to that. But it can also, I mean, it can go wrong very quickly.
Design pillars is definitely something you want to lock in during pre-production for sure, because that's, yeah, those kinds of things are valuable, and that's the kind of stuff you'll want to look back on, you know, as you're doing production and want to make changes. So pre-production, do it. I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, for, you know, an indie team, single person, it's going to look different.
Yes.
Right. You can be putting together your prototype as you're writing your game design document. That's okay.
Right.
I mean, like I was describing with film, where there's that like really hard line for practical purposes. There's less of that in games, and that's bad, but it's also good.
It's efficient. It's just different.
Like we did. When we started pivoting Widget Satchel from a jam game to a full production. I was pretty hard on everybody to make sure we made a lot of decisions before we got too far down the the thing, and that was a sort of a type of pre-production. And like, I'm really glad I did that. Because we could have really spun out very quickly if we didn't, if we just kind of charged forward. And so we all agreed on some pillars. We had discussions about features. We had arguments, and then we settled them. And then we kept them settled unless there was a compelling reason to go back to them. But we were working at the same time. So it wasn't, you know, we didn't wait to get going, because we really couldn't afford to wait to get going, because it was a zero budget project.
Yeah, but that's a good point. Widget Satchel did, we did, sort of have a weird pre-production-esque process.
Well, a lot of, I think my motivation for that comes a lot from when I was doing film, where it's like, you really have to know, like, yes, you've got your script done, but if you didn't do your storyboards, then you have to make sure that you take really good notes, or else you're going to, every scene is going to look different. And it's like, this would be a really great one-er, but is it a good place in the movie for that? And it's, so you want to have a lot of, you want to justify your choices, or you want to at least frame the environment that you'll be making your choices during production. So that when it's time to make the choices, trying to do the work, you want to make sure that you are making the choice in the spirit of the game design pillars, or in the context of the rest of the project. Because you have no shortage of good ideas. But it doesn't always mean it's going to be the right idea. And it's really hard to know the difference.
Absolutely.
Because when you have a good idea, like, all you want to do is bring it to life. You know?
Yeah. And that's what, that's the exact thing that pre-production will help you figure out, design, or decide for. Is that kind of stuff. So it's valuable. I would encourage listeners to at least give it some thought as to whether or not, you know, a structured pre-production process is valuable for you or not. But at least think about it, because I think there's a lot of value to it. More value than I had initially thought of when I didn't even think the term actually existed. NiceGames.club/Discord. We have tons of conversations. Specifically, our community does. If you're interested in hearing from listeners like yourselves and having conversations about the show, you can jump into NiceGames.club/Discord.
If at any point you're like, hey, Steven, I disagree.
Yeah, specifically with me. Actually?
Or, yo, Mark, that's dumb. Or, Ellen, I agree.
Yep.
And I'm going to praise you for it. Those are three common listener. That's the feedback we've gotten mostly.
That's true. That's pretty accurate.
If you want to add to, you know, or maybe your own spin on those responses, you can do that with other listeners.
Yes.
Which is probably a little bit more useful than just complaining directly to us.
Right. Right. Because I'm not going to say anything back to you. You can.
Yeah. I mean, good luck getting Steven to change his mind.
Right. You know. I'm stubborn.
But if you can marshal the rest of the audience in, behind you. Then you know, Steven will have nothing to lean against.
That's a good point.
Get that peer pressure.
Yeah. I might have to actually reconsider my opinions if you get a bunch of people to do it.
That's the power of community. And you can get that nicegames.club/Discord.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, so for my topic today, I've got a backstory.
Okay.
So strap in. I don't know how good it is. So last week, I was biking home, and what happens a lot is that cars will park in the bike lane. And it sucks because they're parking in traffic.
Right.
Oh, like they got their hazards on. They're like, I'm just going to be here for a minute or whatever. Yeah. I'm waiting for someone, or I'm an Uber driver or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like when you're parking on the shoulder or in front of a fire hydrant for like a minute, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we all got lives to live. You don't have to follow the rules to the letter.
Right.
But when you're parking in a bike lane, you are parking in traffic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's my PSA to all of you out there, because I think everybody's done it.
Hmm.
Like that's because I see it a lot, but also like I could see people justifying it.
Yeah.
So first part of my story.
Don't do that.
Is do not park in a bike lane.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no shoulder, then you cannot park there.
Yeah.
That's just boohoo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm bringing it up is because I was biking home and there's a car on the bike, and I usually just have to swerve around them.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty busy street.
Yeah.
And so I just had this narrow thing. Otherwise, I was going to go into the lane of traffic.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
So a lot of times I will put my arm out to signal, but it was too busy for I couldn't get in.
Yeah.
And you have to, when you're trying to change lanes on a bike, you have to be like triple sure the cars will let you, because they don't expect you to move even or to recognize your signals. Just like, anyway, long story short, I clipped this guy's side mirror as I was trying to weave around him, and I fell off my bike and I got pretty hurt.
Ugh.
I was laid out all that weekend and most of the beginning of the next week. And so here comes the actual relevance.
Okay.
I started playing an idle game on my phone, which is not something I've really ever done.
Okay.
And we've talked about free to play and sort of the ethical quandaries of that. And I'm going to get into a little bit of that again.
Mm.
But I wanted to talk a little bit of kind of almost do a little bit of a case study here on this particular game, because I took a lot of notes as I was playing because we had just done that episode about
journaling,
game journaling.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how useful this is going to be a lot of people. I think this is going to be something a lot of people have already experienced, or they already know these things. Mm. But I was surprised by some of the things as I played through this game, because a lot of my understanding of idle games, clicker games, you know, games that are generally, you know, high user acquisition. They are funded by ads and by microtransactions.
Right.
A lot of that is mostly like my thoughts on paper, right? Because I don't play these games. Like I've never been attracted to them. I feel that they have like ethical problems, and so I don't know the experience of playing them. So it's very academic.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've learned a little bit more, and I want to talk about some of that. So the first thing is I played this game because it's a Star Trek game, because that got me there, basically.
Yeah.
It's called Star Trek Lower Decks, The Badgy Directive. So if people know the show Lower Decks, it's the Star Trek sitcom, animated sitcom. We've talked about it on the show before. We all love it. And this is a tie-in game that features one of the Badgy, which is a holographic com badge. Who is evil?
Yeah,
and traps you in the holodeck and toys with you, and voiced by Jack McBrayer, a very funny character.
Uh-huh.
So the premise of this game is that you're trapped in the holodeck and you have to complete a series of drills, but Badgy will never let you go.
Oh,
because Badgy is evil, and basically it's a game that never ends. So it's kind of thematically appropriate.
All right.
And so one of the things that I thought was kind of actually pretty well done about the game is that it does get to sort of have its cake and eat it too with these mechanics.
Yeah.
Because it has a little bit of a fourth wall breaking character at its core.
Yeah.
And I'll talk a little bit more about that later when I talk about theming, because that I thought was pretty interesting. Mm. But my history with these types of games is this game, and then I think I've like open one or two and just to see what they were or whatever, how they start.
Yeah.
But I really have not actually played any game like this, except for years and years ago, I played an idle game on a web page. It was an HTML5 game.
Yeah.
It was a proof of concept because HTML5 was nascent. Mm. And this was like I made this just sort of Farmville style clicker game with HTML5. Check it out. It had no monetization or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I got really into it for all the same Skinner box reasons. Like you just, it is very addictive mechanically. People understand that. I don't need to go over that a lot.
Yeah.
But I felt like, okay, I understand this genre now. And so I think that's kind of where my knowledge of it sort of ended. And I did a little bit of research on what the state of the art was when this genre was invented.
Oh,
about 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's sort of interesting where it's gone, and I'll get into that a little bit. But let's talk a little bit about this game. So it's made by Eastside Games, and they make a bunch of these IP-driven titles.
Mm.
So they have a Wizard of Oz idle game, and a one for The Office, and one for RuPaul's Drag Race.
Sure, why not?
Well, yeah, you'd say the same thing about Star Trek. Like, how could you make that work?
Yeah,
like, I figured it out. And what I didn't find out until I started doing some research is that it's really a reskinned project. Like, they basically have made a white label product, and then they skin it.
Yeah, I think I saw some screenshots and I was like, this looks exactly like this other one.
So, yeah. And but they actually do a really good job of adapting the IP. But that's where they put in their work is like on the art, on the writing, on all the Easter eggs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The mechanics are kind of like figured out.
Okay.
So this is sort of like the platonic ideal of a clicker idle game.
Mm.
It doesn't have a lot of unique mechanics because it's meant to work for a lot of different things.
Right.
There are some tweaks that are made per IP.
Yeah.
At least that's my understanding anyway. But it's pretty much a reskinned product.
Okay.
And I didn't know that at the time, but it makes a lot more sense now. The thing is, it starts out really interesting. Like the theme is really strong, and everything starts out very fast with these games.
Yeah.
Actually, the first time I played it, I didn't really understand what any of the buttons were.
Oh.
It almost kind of like expected me to know. It's sort of like every time I play a game that has loot, and I'm like, what does purple mean?
Yeah.
It's like every game uses the same colors, but because I don't play that genre, the first time I pick up one, the game expects me to know this already.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take long to learn, but like it rubs you the wrong way.
Yeah, it's friction.
It expects you these genre conventions.
Yep.
Purple's good.
Yeah. Thanks, Aaron.
Purple is very good.
Yeah.
You want purple.
So everything is really fast and very rewarding at the beginning.
Yeah.
And that is specifically so that when the game slows down, and in every time I've read about this or seen videos, people's observations or their design intent is not that it slows down. It slows down exponentially. You're meant to hit a wall.
Yeah. Yep.
It's not meant to sneak up on you, actually. Yeah. And the reason is because you're meant to have this validation, the reward, and then just long enough for you to really miss it when it's taken from you.
Mm-hmm. You have a long reinforcement history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of obvious problems that, you know, that it funnels people into microtransactions, and that's like obvious. People know that about it.
Right.
But I think the interesting thing that I learned is that the sort of like waiting or like paying to not wait or that kind of push and pull isn't so much the problem, like isn't really what's wrong with these games. Mm. It's that the balance of it is like broken on purpose. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of, I don't know how much of a distinction this is, but it's something I looked at a little bit different way. Like I was thinking like, oh, the whole point is to make everything annoying, and so you have to pay to make it not annoying.
Yeah.
But that's not really the problem. It's not like core to the mechanic. It's that the balance, the numbers that are configured are such that it kind of, you could make it satisfying forever.
Right.
And it would just be a fidget toy.
Yeah.
Right? Where you just keep getting rewarded at a right scale. It kind of hovers above and below the line of like cost versus inventory. Mm-hmm. And you could do that, but you don't. You break these numbers on purpose.
Yeah.
So that, you need 50? Well, I'll give you 30. And that is all I'll do. Then you're on your own, you know. But if you want, there's like the shop in the corner, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, like I said, it's a minor distinction, but I didn't quite fully understand until I was like really feeling that sense of like, oh, I could optimize this and get it all working. Oh, I can't. Like,
right.
There's actually no way to be. So that's sort of my other observation about it is that, I mean, idle games as a point, they're not meant to be skill based, right?
Yeah.
But you do resource management, and that is something people find great satisfaction in,
right.
And that's what makes the game fun early on, and that's what it takes away from you.
Yeah,
is that satisfaction? And so once you get over that hump, and as you like play through different rounds or the sort of new game plus of it all, you never get that back.
Yeah.
And so essentially the game stops, but you have the memory of it.
Yeah.
Right.
You associate the rewards you get with the satisfaction that those first 20 minutes gave you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, really, the first 20 minutes is where all the gameplay happens. Then it's gone forever. And that is something that surprised me very much. Mm-hmm. I thought that they would be like, oh, well, yeah, it's, you know, it's a evil Skinner box, but like, it's still a game, right? No, it's 100% not a game.
Okay, so I do want to make a distinction between, you know, this particular game, and not just, like, there's a lot of games like this. Not specifically just this particular game. But there are other idle games that are not built in this way that aren't, you know, there aren't, well, a lot of them aren't paid. There was this idle game that I used to play called Candy Box.
Yeah.
And then they made a sequel, Candy Box 2, where, like, the game, you know, you get candy over time, and then you eventually get a button that allows you to click to get more candy over time.
Yeah.
And then that expands. Once you get enough candy, you start getting more buttons and more things, and then there's suddenly an RPG system. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff in that game that's it's really fascinating.
Plot twist.
Yeah. There are a bunch of idle games like that that came about around the time that this genre was created.
Right. And that's telling, because it's not that the genre itself is inextricably linked to black hat behavior or monetization.
Mm.
And it's just that that's all that's left.
Yeah.
Essentially.
That's a lot of it.
Because that's how you can't, because every video I saw from someone who makes these games describing how they work, they always start out with like, it's like magic. Retention is so high with this genre.
Yeah.
It's like, it's like arbitrage for these developers. They just can't believe it.
Mm.
And it is kind of impossible if you're running a business to not do something about that.
Yeah.
And so that is kind of, it's not that the mechanic itself is prey to that pull of monetization, the pay to win model. It's that those numbers are designed broken on purpose for that purpose.
Yeah.
Now that is separate entirely from the sort of emotional that reward loop that is not tied to monetization that applies to the games you're talking about.
Right. Well, and so that's the thing about idle games that I find really compelling is that a lot of times there's a lot of delayed gratification that come from idle games that you don't get in regular games. Most of the time in games, you design a way to make players feel rewarded as quickly as possible so that they keep playing the game until they finish.
Right.
But with idle games, it's designed to keep you going for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so like with that candy box game, you know, I would keep getting new mechanics and stuff and new things to do. And I'd be like, oh, I got to keep playing this game so I can get more stuff to do. And I just kept playing it and then more stuff kept popping up. And that felt really satisfying.
Right. And that's the distinction separate from the monetization yes. ethics. But that I believe also has is ethically problematic.
Oh,
and one of the things that was really interesting, I came across a paper mm-hmm. That we'll link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. It's essentially almost like a researcher interviewed a bunch of developers and then wrote a very technical paper for a .gov website.
Okay.
But one of the I pulled a quote from it that's so fascinating to me. Several of our interviewees expressed the desire to give players an opportunity to stop playing their games if they choose to, rather than requiring their players to remain forever trapped in a cycle of never-ending logarithmic scaling. Mm. These reflections indicate a degree of concern from our interviewees about the potential of these games to lead to unhealthy, unending play.
Oh.
And that really was interesting to me because it really is separating out the monetization play versus just the core of these games, mm-hmm. just the endless play.
Well, that's interesting because I guess I wasn't thinking of the games as endless. I definitely see a lot of yeah. these games are endless, like Cookie Clicker, you know, yeah. just goes on even though it's free.
But that's what there's some more quotes from the people that talk about this yeah. this what they're trying to do. It's like I wish this genre allowed us to have to let the player be done with it, and that they struggle with that, and that is their ethical concern. Hmm. And this comes from indie developers who are using different pay models,
right.
like subscriptions or premium. There are premium idle games.
Yeah.
They don't do very well, but people do sell them.
Yeah.
Or Patreon or something like that, where it's set up that way, less tied to the gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
Even those types of games and the developers who make them recognize the scary emotional and psychological effect it has on people.
Yeah.
And so that separating those things out was something I didn't think a lot about. I thought like, oh, this model is not interesting unless it leads to this monetization, and this monetization yeah. is evil, and that's a straight line A to B. But uh-huh. it actually, they are different things. They just go so well together.
Yeah.
yeah.
That is what worries me. And I think we've talked about this on the show about games that do never end, MMOs and competitive games that are mm-hmm. and games that have seasons and are meant to just be a hobby unto themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's anything definitionally wrong about a game that is like a hobby.
Sure.
I mean, like there's no end to baseball, right? You can just play another game of baseball.
Yeah.
like you can play another round of Overwatch or mm-hmm. whatever.
Right.
But I think there is a lot of problem with games that do have this kind of like number go up thing that is separate from the concern that I have about their monetization.
Mm, okay. Well,
and then you combine that with just the easy access of a mobile phone.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And then that you've kind of got this trifecta of hooked.
Yeah. So the other thing that was really interesting is watching a GDC talk from 2015, talking about this that really only been around a year or two that as a genre and was already starting to find its way into sort of being a big revenue source for companies. It was that's where they sort of started.
Yeah.
Is 2014, 2015, 2016. And a really interesting thing that the person was saying was showing charts of like, this is our pie chart of what players spend on the game.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, 40% of players who spend anything at all will spend less than $10. And then there's this tiny sliver that spends like $100 or more.
Yeah.
A smaller sliver still spends $1,000 or more, yeah. right? And it's whales, right? We understand that topic. It's not news to most people.
Yeah.
But then this other chart was how much of the revenue of the game total is provided by those audiences.
Mm.
And something like 40 to 60% of the revenue for any successful idle game is brought in by people who are spending more than $100
yeah.
over the lifetime of the game.
Yep. Hmm.
And so this is, I think I've laid out this criticism before of free-to-play games is one of the things that people say that's good about free-to-play games is that it's free. So it gives a lot of people access to games they wouldn't otherwise have. But I feel like that is not worth the trade-off, which is that these games are funded entirely by people who are spending too much money and who are emotionally trapped buy them. Mm. And I don't think that's worth the upside of providing a huge amount of people with free entertainment. I think somebody does pay for it, right? And that worries me a lot. And what was interesting about the talk from this person who was like, we make a bunch of these games and we're and this is really cool and you can make one. They're really not that hard to make. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, it felt like a talk. I don't want to like, we'll link this in the show notes and I don't want to like, you know, call this person out or anything like that. Yeah. But it really just sounded like they were giving like a multi-level marketing talk. Mm. It was like the thing that really, really scared me about this talk and other things I was seeing, presentations, is how they were sort of just dismissing any kind of ethical concern as if it didn't exist. Mm. Not saying like, oh, you know, we heard and we try our best. You know, like you hear like the NFL is like, we're worried about player concussions, and they're not really.
Yeah.
At least they have the shame to tell you that they care about it.
Uh-huh.
Right? And that, you know, you don't believe them, but, you know, they at least. But to hear people talk about these things and just to act as if that issue does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, you can almost see them stepping around it. And that was really scary to me. And that's from 2015. And so one of the things that person did was they had some predictions about where the genre would go, and they were really excited about it. Like, this is a new genre, it's a new payment model, and new players are getting in, and they had a lot of like really interesting, they're really excited about it, like genuinely excited about it as a model for developers.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought like, okay, you know, the spreadsheet style game will fall out of favor and there'll be more interesting mechanics will be developed. What we're looking at now is not going to be what it's going to be like a couple years. Wrong. Like the way he described the mechanics and like, oh, this is a new thing that these games introduced and a couple people have started monetizing them. But by, you know, in a couple of years, there'll be so much innovation in this genre. It'll be, and there really has not been.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of shocked me. But I could totally see why you'd think there would be. But the thing is, it works. It makes money. It works. Any changes you make is a risk to that model.
Right.
And so that was really telling, I thought.
Yeah.
Innovation
is sparked from need if it's already working. And there's
Exactly. And this presenter had a lot of hope. It's like, it's going to be so interesting. People are going to come up with such cool ideas. And people really haven't. And I mean, Stephen, like what you're talking about, a lot of that innovation happened in non-monetized.
Yeah.
Spaces because there was more like it was for that sake, you know.
Right. There was a whole story they wanted to tell.
Yeah.
Over a period of time, I guess.
One of the other predictions was that idle will become a modifier for other genres. Hmm. So you have like an idle Mario type game. You'll have an idle RPG. You'll have an idle tactics game, and that really hasn't happened.
They did make it. That was a premium game. There's a mobile Mario game, but it was a premium game, so it's not the same thing.
Yeah. But the idea of like the game plays for you. Like
right.
They were like the prediction was like idle is something that could be a modifier to other types of games
mm-hmm.
that you could like you could and this has been true in some and there are examples of these sorts of things where you can have games play for you. And then you come back to play them yourself. MMOs have done this, can do this sometimes.
Right.
But I think the prediction was really much that it was going to be like more broadly accepted variant of types of games, which was sort of interesting. And I think part of the reason is because designers, they want their players to play these games. It's like not rocket science, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was sort of a mix of like how it felt innovative at the time. It felt like a good way to bring new revenue streams to developers. So clearly, it reminded me a lot of the sort of like, oh, blockchain games will be big.
Yeah.
Like, why? Because it's new and people like new things and they'll innovate. Like, well, but why? And no one has an answer for that.
Yeah.
I felt like that prediction really very much reminded me of those kinds of things.
Mm.
It's like it seemed like it didn't seem like a stupid thing for someone to say.
Yeah.
Because it's like, here's this new thing. It's interesting. We haven't explored all of its corners yet. It's going to be integrated into all sorts of things. It's kind of the future and it won't replace things, but it'll be a part of it. And I don't think that happened,
mm-hmm.
just like it's not going to happen with blockchain games. And so that was really interesting. And one thing the prediction that he totally nailed was that there'd be idle spin-offs of games and brands. So you'll have like a popular game and then you'll have the idle mobile version of it. That has happened, but the brands is where it really came into. That's the one I played, right?
Yeah.
That is a way to draw people in. And I thought that was a really interesting prediction because it really played into the sort of, it's a piece of merchandise or a piece of marketing or brand extension.
Yeah.
And that does feel like a very good fit for something like this, mm-hmm. right? It's merch, essentially.
Yeah.
Right?
It's, yeah. Yeah.
And one of the sort of last prediction was that, you know, idle game design philosophies will integrate into the metagame of standard genres. So that's a little bit what I was saying before, that like some of those mechanics will come into other games. So loot boxes is part of it. You know, a lot of Ubisoft games went through that period, and then they've been pulling back on it lately.
Yeah.
So I'm like sort of a half yes, I think that has happened in some manner. But I think it hasn't quite been something that has been standard to a lot of games the way that the prediction went. So that was really interesting to me watching this talk and just seeing like this was 2015. This was 7 years ago.
Yeah, as well.
And I've been roughly ignorant of the genre as a player all that time, but then looking into it and having a, you know, just a brief, it's not a, I mean, I'm not an expert just by playing through one game pretty heavily for 4 days.
Yeah.
because I really did get sucked into it to the point where like I was waiting for that next tick to go so I could make sure to hit the button on time, and I stayed up late, and I really, you know, I have an addictive personality, so it's not that surprising to me, but like I did have to just uninstall it.
It really got you.
Yeah, it really did get me, and it was really, really frustrating that it got me, because I was thinking about like all the things that like this could be interesting. It is fun to match up all the things and just get, I'm going to upgrade this but not right away, because I'm going to wait to upgrade this instead. That is a really satisfying play experience that other games have. Civ is very much like that, right? But then very quickly being like, oh, the game does not care if I'm playing optimally or not. It just cares
if you spend money.
If I either spend money or I am playing it at all.
Yeah.
Right? Engaged with it at all. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that frustrated me the most was that the theming was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is true for everybody. But to me, I think what got me most was just the theming is really important, because it's actually not, an idle game is not really at its heart a video game. It's not really an interactive piece of media in the same way that other video games are. And just go with me along on this journey.
Okay.
It really felt more like it was the game does play itself. That's the whole point of it, right?
Yeah.
So it felt a lot like it was just a piece of linear media. So having a strong theme really, really helps with that.
Sure.
And it doesn't have to tell a linear story necessarily. It's essentially, it's like how Twitter or Instagram is. Like you can just scroll through and just enjoy your time with it without actually spending a lot of time interacting with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You don't have to like or post. You can just enjoy it.
Yeah.
And so that's really what it felt like. And so IP tie-ins and theming is really, really strong, really important. And so this is just a rethemed game. There's 7 other versions of it, but I really did enjoy all of the Star Trek Easter eggs, and like they did such a great job with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the thing is, it was so annoying, because I mean, from jump, I'm like, I already hate this genre. Yeah. I prejudged it.
Yeah,
I've already, you know, like I already think it's dumb.
Yeah.
And that it's evil. But like, oh, look at that! I recognize that from an episode. They're like, oh, they didn't have to put that Easter egg in there.
Yeah,
and it shows a lot of. This is true of any ethical quandary in games. People talk about crunch. People talk about all sorts of the things that is wrong with this industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's always wrapped in all the things that's right about it.
Well, yeah.
And so it's always hard to extract what's wrong, because there are good people making these bad things, and they deserve their paychecks, and they deserve your support, and they are expressing themselves creatively in a way that is like good for themselves and for the world.
And
yet it's all, it is wrapped around these things that are sort of rotten to their core.
That's the thing that I think that with idle games, I don't think that idle games inherently need to be problematic. Even in the way that, like, the designers were describing, you know, the ways that they were making idle games.
Yeah.
And that, like, I wish I could make the game have an ending.
Right.
I think that games can have, well, they can have limits or endings in some form.
Yeah.
Even these games. In a way that can make it more ethically reasonable. But still stay true to the heart of what you're trying to make. And I'm not here going to tell you how to do that now, because... This is only an hour-long program.
Right. And I don't really want to debate you on it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think either of us are prepared for that.
Right.
But I really don't agree.
Okay.
I really don't think there's a way. I think there's a way to mitigate its problems, but there's... I mean, it's sort of similar to like online toxicity. Like it, that happens because of the way that those games are built.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do a lot of work to prevent those things or to, but you caused the problem.
Mm.
And so, you know, you can do a lot of work to prevent it from harming people, but you did cause the problem. And I think that's what this genre does, independent of the monetization model.
Right, yeah.
So I kind of came away from it with like a newfound hatred of the genre. And it felt like a bit of discovery, but not like I changed my mind exactly.
Mm.
So I'm not sure how useful this topic is to people. But like, but that theming thing really, really like stuck with me, like how interesting that was and how when it breaks down, the spell kind of breaks.
Yeah.
So in this idle game, you know, you get a currency that is reset every round, right? So that's kind of common.
Yeah.
And then there's another currency that is for upgrades, mm-hmm. and then a currency that you can then pay real money for that can buy you the currency that gives you upgrades.
Yeah.
So it's that multi-level obfuscation that makes these things work.
Right.
But sort of for example, you have each of these holodeck simulations you can assign crew members to mm-hmm. with your points. And each of those can be upgraded, blah, blah, anyway, yada, yada. But at a certain point, the numbers, they go up this logarithmic. You get billions and trillions. And then you have these notations. It's AA, mm-hmm. AB, which is like, it just makes no sense at all. Mm. It doesn't track it to the theme at all. And then suddenly you're putting 700 people at the warp core, like, to make it run fast. And you're just like, okay, the theme is totally broken now.
Right. Yeah.
And it's amazing how quickly that happens. But just like with mechanically, it gets you early, and then you have that remembrance based on the rewards you get.
Yeah.
You are rewarded for your play.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time you're rewarded later, you attach that to being rewarded for play, even though you're not playing. It's very similar with the theming, where as you upgrade characters and as you use the, you know, trillions upon gazillions of points to put 1,000 people in the shuttle bay to improve the efficiency of that part of that simulation.
Yeah.
Like, you remember when it made sense that you assigned Mariner to the shuttle bay.
Mm.
Like, that you remember that, like, oh, that's cool. I'm kind of playing along with the story. And then when it becomes absolutely ridiculous, all you're left with was the memory of those rewards that are attached to those things.
Right.
And so it's really important. But it is the form itself will eventually break it. And I believe that's true.
Okay. Again, I disagree with that.
Yeah.
But I mean, like I said, we're not going to debate it here now.
Yeah, we'll have to come back to this one because we're out of time. I also am with Steven. I think I disagree. But I'm going to send you a game to play.
Yeah?
Oh,
yeah.
Dear.
Yeah, I'll send you a game to play and we can come back next time. We can talk about it.
That's the way to win a debate, is to give other people homework.
Yeah.
Well...
Because I'm not going to do it. So then essentially you'll win unchallenged.
Yeah, it is.
I already win.
Uncontested.
Since I already win, I don't even have to send it to you.
Yeah. Shortcut all the way through.
That's our show. Let's see if I can do this outro without fumbling over my words.
Taking bets.
For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter at Knights Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and importing models into Unity. Helpful stuff. We like hearing from you, so tweet back or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and you get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual or actually like really get into it, you can come by nicegames.club/discord and say hello and tell Mark he's wrong.
All right, until we get going again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.